From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hey, did you watch the big healthcare summit?
More than a quarter of small businesses have reported a premium increase of 20% or more just last year.
On the Democratic side, President Barack Obama displayed virtuosic command of legal and technical arcana. For the GOP, Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander affably voiced what came off as principled Republican desire to start health care reform afresh. Could this extraordinary meeting deliver an oasis of comity and sanity in an ideologically riven Washington? Of course not. As another Republican remarked, the whole spectacle was a setup, because in the face of such carefully crafted presidential collegiality, the repetition of the standard GOP talking points could only appear as intransigence, or worse, as in this exchange between the president and Senator John Barrasso, a Wyoming medical doctor.
Would you be satisfied if every member of Congress just had catastrophic care? You think we'd be better health care purchasers? I mean, you think, is that a change that we should make?
Yeah, I think actually we would. We'd really focus on it. You'd have more, as we say, skin in the game.
Because
people would, and especially if they had a savings account, a health savings account, they could put their money into
would you
that,
feel the same
and they'd
way
be if, spending the money out of that.
Would you feel the same way if you were making $40,000?
Yes, sirree. Thursday's televised bipartisan health care summit was something else, which is to say, not a summit at all, but something else. Political theater staged by the White House to juxtapose presidential rigor with GOP posturing on Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and, of course, C-SPAN. Performed to boost support for using the reconciliation process to pass health care reform? Probably. A prescription for drama? Certainly.
I hope that this isn't political theater, where we're just playing to the cameras and criticizing each other, but instead are actually trying to solve the problem.
Physician, heal thyself. When Senator John McCain, Obama's erstwhile presidential rival, accused the president of reneging on campaign promises, the president gave the cameras quite a show.
Let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning anymore. The election's over.
I'm reminded of that every day.
Ouch. McCain was flustered, but not as flustered as he seemed later when he complained about a provision in the Democratic plan that he characterized as a naked Democratic payoff to Florida seniors, and the president agreed. Double ouch. How do you portray a president as an agent of socialism when he sits there stubbornly being reasonable? And when they trotted out familiar talking points instead of policy nitty-gritty, the president was ready for that, too.
I'd like to make sure that this discussion is actually a discussion and not just us trading talking points.
A talking point about talking points. And thus did the party of no become the party of oh no. And because Republicans had demanded precisely such a televised summit, they were trapped. They knew it. The president knew it, and Fox News Channel's Shepard Smith also knew it.
I think they're outraged already that we sit up there and waste all this time and talk about things just so that later the Democrats can say, we tried, as if you thought the Republicans were going to come around to this thing. Poppycock.
There was a slim chance that this six-hour forum could vent a little fresh air into a polluted political process. But instead, we saw a duel. The GOP took most of the hits, but was not unseated. Several million citizens did check it out on the White House website, but gradually the cable news channels drifted off in search of fresh cud to chew. 4.5 hours in, Fox News had shifted to its studio programming, sometimes showing the summit on screen on mute, while CNN indulged in polls and hot air. MSNBC pulled out a mere 2 hours into the summit to televise another Olympian confrontation, a hockey match between Sweden and Finland. In that contest, one team definitely won and the other lost. Or not. Both of those countries have universal health care. England Island offers tourists all kinds of attractions. There's Hyde Park, Big Ben, and of course its unique libel laws. Libel laws the world over are intended to prevent people from publishing untrue, damaging claims about each other. But Britain's law is uniquely plaintiff-friendly. Unlike American law, it places the burden of proof on alleged libelers to defend their work. He or she is guilty until proven innocent. That's bad, not just for British journalists, but for journalists worldwide who publish anything that can be accessed on the internet. One American author was sued by a Saudi sheikh for a book she wrote, not published in the UK, because the sheikh's lawyers claimed that 26 people in England had read it. But all this may be about to change. On Wednesday, the chairman of Britain's House of Commons Committee on Culture, Media, and Sport said it was, quote, a humiliation that American states were writing laws explicitly to protect U.S. citizens from British libel suits. The committee issued a set of recommendations that could mark the beginning of reform. John Kampfner is head of Index on Censorship, a UK-based NGO that advocates for free speech. He describes how British libel laws have created a cottage industry of lawyers making their living off of frivolous lawsuits.
Legal companies are encouraging the rich and the powerful to claim damage to their British reputation. And all you need is a small office or a second home in the UK, and you can sue. And there's a whole series of procedures that have weighted the balance entirely towards the litigant and away from the defendant.
Can you summarize what those provisions are?
One of them is the cost mechanism, which is very easy for people to string out cases, effectively threatening people. The costs are so great that people's cash flow is irrevocably damaged.
These are what are called slap suits in the United States.
Yeah.
Suits that a large company knows it will probably lose, but just the threat of costly litigation will cause the righteous party to yield.
This is the chilling effect. What's happening is that people are self-censoring. They're not publishing. I hear this from publishing companies, not just in the UK, but in the US and elsewhere, who are simply taking out points, even in fiction. We're not even talking about non-fiction or political books, in case they get sued by a British court.
What do you mean by taking out points?
For example, NGOs, charities, or agencies that try to shine a light on corruption are very scared now of writing things in their reports in case that particular dictatorship uses a British court to sue them. So you could have, for example, a Russian NGO saying something critical about a Ukrainian oligarch, and that Ukrainian oligarch uses the courts in London to seek redress. We have become, as the saying goes, a town called Sue. The Select Committee, they're looking to change this whole question of jurisdiction. In other words, if you are a foreigner, you can use British courts, but you have to satisfy the judges that Britain is a very serious part of your corporate or personal life. It's not just somewhere you might visit for 2 or 3 days a year. So it's going to, in one fell swoop, remove some of this more ridiculous form of libel tourism.
The Guardian's Paul Farrelly wrote this week that he had asked the committee to reconsider the libel laws after attempts were made to prevent his newspaper, The Guardian, and the rest of the UK press from reporting last October on a toxic waste dumping scandal in Africa.
Mm.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, we were very familiar with it. Paul Farrelly, in actual fact, became several years ago a Labour Member of Parliament. He introduced a question concerning an oil trading company called Trafigura and allegations that it had dumped toxic waste in the African country of Ivory Coast. Now, under Britain's long-established constitutional provisions, parliamentarians can say whatever they wish, either in questions to government ministers or in the chamber of Parliament, and that no libel or other laws can intervene. That has been regarded as sacrosanct. On this occasion, however, the law firm representing this company threatened the Guardian newspaper that the fact of reporting this parliamentary question would render it subject to libel, which was an astonishing overreaching and led to quite a major constitutional fracas. The Ministry of Justice is now going to say that no law firm has any right to threaten Parliament. But it really did show the hubris of litigant companies And as we've just seen with this Select Committee report, things are beginning to change.
So do you think then that there is momentum for substantive change in British libel laws now? I mean, what do you think will really come of all of this?
There is most definitely momentum for libel reform. You have to, however, see this in the perspective also of quite a great deal of public scepticism about the role of the press in the UK. The reason this parliamentary report, in my opinion, was so strong was that it sought to differentiate between good, robust, well-researched investigative journalism with the more prurient, invasive tabloid journalism.
So can you tell me how these proposals distinguish between good investigative reporting and prurient tabloid reporting? It seems to be a sticky wicket.
To use a British cricketing phrase. But on these issues of privacy, whether you're talking about Tiger Woods on your side of the Atlantic or a famous soccer player called John Terry, who until recently was the England football captain and who has had the captaincy taken away from him also for various extramarital affairs, it is hard to determine what is in the public's interest and what is not. And, you know, a supercilious way of saying public interest is anything that the public is interested in. But there are legitimate areas if there's illegality, if there is hypocrisy. So if it's a politician who talks about family values and then acts contrary to that, there are fewer and fewer journalists out there researching important stories. And if the media is drawing itself down to the lowest common denominator, then we will all be ill-served.
Well, John, keep us posted. You think we'll know anything in a year?
Put it this way, I'll be very disappointed if we haven't, over here, had substantial change for the better within 6 months.
All right. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
John Kampfner is chief executive of Index on Censorship.
Coming up, by your keystrokes shall you be known, and other tales from the surveillance state.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Next time you're at your computer keyboard, stop for a moment and notice the way you type. Not the words, but the pattern. Are you, We all have idiosyncrasies in the way we type. For example, how long we pause between keystrokes. Companies are now using new software that can record and analyze those typing patterns to see if we are who we say we are online. We first read about the software on the Ars Technica blog, which we'll link to. Apparently, the software is useful for companies that sell limited access to their expensive databases. Pattern recognition can weed out poachers who log in with somebody else's password. Harvard law student and blogger at the Citizen Media Law Project, Andrew Mashurnia, says it's just a new twist on handwriting analysis, but an ominous one. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So in a way, this is reminiscent of handwriting analysis, but maybe more particularly, going back to World War II, the tracking by the Allies of Axis radio operators to determine their signature fists, they were called, their patterns of keystrokes in Morse code.
Right. A large number of British interceptors, which were primarily British women, were listening to the Morse code being picked up by the Allies from the Axis. And after a while, they were able to discern patterns and be able to identify, you know, this particular person, you know, Hans Grunberg is typing out this message. I don't know what this message says, but I know that Hans Grunberg is linked to this U-boat. So this is a way that we can discern, you know, movement patterns of different units. And they did this with, you know, great success.
Okay, so if Hans, the radio operator, has a signature fist, maybe some terrorist also has a signature fist, and maybe Courtney, the 17-year-old high school student pirating music, also has a fist. If we can recognize that fist, we can track her anywhere.
That's sort of the hope militarily, and that's the fear domestically.
It doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to imagine many other uses for this kind of pattern recognition software. I'm thinking of intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies using it without a warrant to identify people who may not even realize they're being tracked.
Well, I think to understand that, you'd have to look at the difference between positive and negative identification. So the idea of positive identification would be you can track a user by this fingerprint. So looking at this site and this site and this site, we see the same cadence, so this must be the same user. I don't think we're there yet. I do think that we're approaching the idea of having a pretty robust system of negative identification. That is, we can be relatively certain that this was not the target user. And why that's really important for law enforcement is that, in the end, this sort of is always the last-ditch excuse for, okay, we've tracked your IP address, we have linked you to this illegal activity, what do you have to say? And the response is always, well, that wasn't me. It was a virus. It was someone that broke into my Wi-Fi network. And so this would be just one more piece of data to help explain whether or not it was or was not you.
Let's just assume for a moment that the algorithm gets a bit more sophisticated. Is it possible to crawl the web looking for matches of someone's known typing fingerprint to know what exactly they are typing somewhere on the net right now?
If you have a state that devotes significant resources to this and is able to limit the number of users, certainly. Iran, for example, that just got rid of Gmail and now everything is going through their own proprietary email system. That's incredibly terrifying.
We've talked about a couple of ways that the software could be abused. What haven't we mentioned?
The big thing is that if I know what your cadence is and I'm practiced at your cadence, I could impersonate you. So if I want to discredit someone, I could go on to a very bad site and I could engage in sort of fake digital fingerprinting.
Yikes.
It's scary. It's really, really scary stuff. But I mean, that's like four or five levels beyond than where we're at right now.
You know, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is abject terror, how spooked should we be about this latest opportunity to figure out who we are when we perhaps would like to remain anonymous?
Right now, I'm not very scared. I'd put myself at about a 2. Because unless I'm using one of those proprietary systems that has this software already in place, I'm not that worried. What should scare us, and I'd put this more around like a 7 or an 8, because if we don't know we're being observed, it would be very, very difficult to enact a countermeasure. You would have to use either a software interrupt or a different typing style to get around the problem.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Andrew Mashurnia is a law student at Harvard University and a blogger for Harvard's Citizen Media Law Project. Matt Shanahan is the vice president of strategy at Scout Analytics, which does this typing pattern analysis for its 40 clients. He says there is nothing sinister about collecting this data.
First of all, there's actually no way to tie it back to the individual themselves, at least through our data sets that we have. Secondly, those patterns aren't universally unique. It turns out that there's probably 20,000 individualized patterns. So it's not like a fingerprint or an iris in that sense. It's statistically meaningful, and when combined with the IP location that somebody came from, et cetera, it can help build a profile. But you know, I think sometimes people say, wow, you know, this is suddenly an eye behind me tracking everything I do, and that's really not the case.
All right, Matt, let me just give you what I think is the nightmare scenario, and you tell me if, you know, you can disabuse me of this fear, all right? The government decides they want to surveil somebody. Let's just say me. And they learn my patterns of typing using software like yours, and then they crawl the internet looking for someone with a signature exactly like mine to see what I'm writing online anytime, anywhere. Is that a paranoid concern?
Yeah. If they want to track you, there's a lot of better ways to do it. The better way for them to track you is to track your device and IP locations. And even though you may try and mask that, it's a lot easier to get a beat on you that way than any other way.
Have you heard from the FBI, from the National Security Agency, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, anywhere else in law enforcement or intelligence apparatus asking to learn more?
We've worked with agencies in the past, government agencies that wanted more secure networks. again, the reality is typing pattern is one factor. That factor on its own is insufficient. That being said, also the limits of why it's not going to be able to get finer is the actual timing resolution only gets down to 1 millisecond. And to take it deeper than that, you'd have to redo all the operating systems, all the keyboards, everything across the network.
So what you're saying is, even if the software advances, that the limitation, the physical infrastructure of the world of computing makes it structurally impossible to refine this technology to the point that it becomes frightening.
Right. We just don't see that infrastructure changing that quickly.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying it's not that I shouldn't worry about privacy and technology, but I have much scarier things to worry about than this.
I certainly think that measurement on the web is advancing way beyond the ability to look at a set of keystroke patterns. When you take into account what the new mobile devices can do about taking pictures, fixing location down to exact spots, even at least a cell phone tower, a lot more is learned through the newer technologies than the old keyboard.
Okay, Matt. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Matt Shanahan is the Vice President of Strategy at Scout Analytics.
Even without our keystroke patterns, we leave behind piles of identifiers ripe for collection. Banking statements, phone records, Google searches. And since George W. Bush declared a war on terror, government officials and civil libertarians have battled over access to that data. In his new book, The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, reporter Shane Harris traces that fight, which predates 9/11, and he puts one man, John Poindexter, at the center of the government's quest for more personal data. Best known for his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair, Poindexter was deputy national security advisor in the Reagan administration, and he argued that collecting the personal data of the masses was a crucial step in fighting terrorism. John Poindexter's quest to do just that, says Harris, in many ways began with the 1983 bombing of Marine barracks in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War by members of a group called Islamic Jihad.
It was really the first big use of suicidal religious terrorism. It really kind of introduced Americans to the idea of the suicide bomber. And in going back and looking at sort of the reports that had been written about the attack, there were all of these clues, these pieces of intelligence in different silos of the government, some by the military, some by the CIA, a little bit by the FBI, and nobody had sort of put those pieces together. This was the beginning not only of his personal quest to do that, but this elusive dream within government to try and connect the dots about disaster before it occurs.
How did he manage to send us down the road while he was working in the Reagan administration?
So he first set out to, number one, tie the computer systems together so that the various agencies could access each other's information. But the other thing he did was sort of a bureaucratic reshuffling. He led the creation of a number of new committees that had members from the various agencies that had a role in counterterrorism, and for the first time really got them to sit in a room together and start planning for how they would actually manage crises.
And he was really getting a lot of traction in 1984 and 1985. And then, like Icarus, his wings burn on the Iran-Contra scandal.
That's right. So the Iran-Contra affair, really, it's two covert operations that sort of got sewn together, and it was his idea to put them together. The Americans were selling arms to what they believed were moderate elements in the Iranian government, who were then going to try and secure the release of American hostages being held in Lebanon. So it was a sort of arms for hostages swap. Well, that operation started running a profit. And Poindexter had the idea to take the money from the arms sales and to give it over to the Contras in Nicaragua, who were the anti-communist rebel forces there.
And Congress had cut off funding for the Contras, so this was a way to keep it going without putting it before Congress.
That's right. Now, Poindexter's rationale on this was, while Congress barred the intelligence community from giving money to the Contras, they didn't say anything about the White House and the National Security Council sending them that money. So a very legalistic approach, but politically disastrous, of course, because it engulfs the entire White House. He was ultimately indicted and convicted on charges including lying to Congress, and his career is effectively ended at that time.
So why don't we just leap ahead then to September 11th, 2001, days after the attacks. Poindexter's in the White House and whatever government agency will have him giving a PowerPoint presentation. What's his pitch?
Poindexter's idea was something he called total information awareness. He gets this idea that, wait a second, these 19 people, the 9/11 hijackers, the 19 men who boarded the planes, were moving about in American society. Some of them were transferring money. They were renting hotel rooms. They were buying plane tickets. They were renting cars. They were doing all of these things that leave a digital footprint, but footprints that are held in private databases, commercial databases, not government databases. And what he wanted to do was get access and to marry that up with what the government already knew. Well, the government had never proposed to try and go and tap into these kinds of electronic transactions. And I remember once even asking him, I said, well, I mean, how much did you actually want to get access to in this program? And he just stopped and he looked at me and he said, all of it. That's why we called it total information awareness. And he was just completely serious about this.
And yet you write about one aspect of total information awareness that's been overlooked, the safeguards to civil liberties that Poindexter actually wanted.
So what he said he wanted to do was invest in research of new technology that would actually take all of this data they were collecting, and the term is anonymize it, which means either strip out or encrypt the names and the personal identifying information. So the idea was that an analyst using this total information awareness system, he sees lots of transactions, he sees patterns of activity, but he sees no names. And only if he can make a case that some pattern of electronic activity he's seeing matches up with a pre-known pattern of terrorist activity, only then, and with the order of a judge, can he effectively unlock the encryption and see the names of the people underlying the data.
But nevertheless, total information awareness creeped everybody out. And it was shut down. And basically, the whole undertaking got outsourced to the NSA, the National Security Agency, and then it didn't have any safeguards at all.
That's right. Total information awareness was not a classified program. It was a research operation being run at the Defense Department. In late 2003, Congress pulls the public funding for it, and then very quietly, the National Security Agency breaks the program up into component pieces, makes them all classified, but the one piece of the program that they jettison is the privacy protection research. That was the one piece that they did not want to take over. So they throw it away.
Meanwhile, the database that's being amassed is rife with errors.
That's right. I mean, a master database that they have right now of suspected or known terrorists totals more than 500,000 names. Most of these are certainly false leads. The instinct here is we've been caught by surprise so many times that we just have to collect everything, and eventually we'll figure out how to make sense of it and we'll make some use of it. Well, that day has never actually come. And the analysts who are now responsible for trying to piece together the clues about terrorism are literally drowning in the data. I mean, to give you an example of just the scale of this, the National Counterterrorism Center, which is where various analysts from all of the three-letter spy agencies sit together and try and connect the dots every day, there are 28 different data networks that the analysts can get access to, and within that, 80 different what they call intelligence streams of unique kinds of reports. But there is no system that sits on top of all of it that allows an analyst to go to a screen, type in a keyword, and immediately search all the available data. In many cases, they have to go through some of these networks or databases one by one and ask them the same question. So the need for more sophisticated technology, and even just technology to lash these databases together, is really pressing.
But Poindexter was trying to do this 25 years ago. Is institutional rivalry that entrenched that it can never be overcome?
I think it's entrenched. I'm not sure it can never be overcome, but I think that you're hitting on it. I mean, I think that in the government, particularly in the intelligence community, which is, you know, the culture of secrecy, information is power. And the more information that you have as an agency, the more powerful you are. The less you share it, the more powerful you are. And I think it's largely a culture that comes out of the Cold War. We're not just talking about trying to watch the Soviet army and see how many tanks that they're amassing or how many submarines they're building. We're talking about now trying to figure out what human beings, terrorists, are going to do before they do it. It's a completely different equation. And that mind shift that it requires to tackle that, it just hasn't happened.
Do you think that we're in need of some sort of legal recalibration of how we gather information and how we safeguard our privacy?
Yeah, absolutely. The laws that we have set up to govern intelligence gathering, were largely a reaction to the abuses of the 60s and the 70s, where the government was monitoring people for their political activities. The laws were set up to restrict how the government collected information and under what circumstances it collected. But these were laws that were written in a time when there were comparatively few ways to actually gather data, tapping a phone, using a satellite. Today, there are countless ways that the government can collect information, either covertly through its own channels or even just by going on the internet. So I concluded that we need to have our laws focus not so much on the collection and the acquisition of data, but on setting rules and procedures for what the government actually does with those databases. And that's a matter for Congress and the executive branch to take up. And they're just really not focused on that right now.
Shane, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Shane Harris is a reporter for the National Journal and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State.
Coming up, the sexiest domain name on the web goes on the auction block. No one holds on to this baby for long.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, an Italian court handed out half-year prison sentences to three Google executives. Their crime? Violating privacy law by hosting a video. It's a decision that challenges basic assumptions about whether internet companies are liable for content they host and rattles a widely held understanding of the legal framework of the web. Siva Vaidyanathan is professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia. He says that many in Europe, not least Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who runs an old media empire, have become increasingly resistant to the power of Google. Siva, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob. It's good to be here back.
Describe for me briefly the case that was at the heart of this decision.
Well, back in 2006, some hooligans posted a video to YouTube. They were in Italy. They posted it to the Italian version of YouTube. It showed these boys harassing and beating up a disabled person, and it was quite an alarming video by all accounts. It was apparently up there for a number of weeks before Italian authorities complained to Google, and Google did what it always does, and basically its stated policy and in many places the law, to immediately remove the video. Italian authorities thought, though, that this was a good opportunity to make a point about the changing standards of responsibility and the role that Google and YouTube play in our media environment, and they decided to go after Google executives with criminal charges. This has been sort of in the works for more than a year, but I think we were all surprised by the fact that they actually convicted three Google executives this last week of privacy violations.
All right. Now, in the United States, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the remedy that Google chose, that is to remove the offensive material the moment it was notified, would have been more than enough to hold it harmless from any liability. Neither Google nor any publisher nor any other search engine nor any ISP can be held responsible for content posted on its platform. And the EU has an almost identical law. How could the Italians have prosecuted this to begin with?
Well, the EU works in funny ways, right? There can be a standard at the European level, and then there can be a specific higher level standard in local law. And there can also be questions about enforcement and interpretation and so forth. It's also important to remember, though, that this is a general principle of network communication. We don't want, for instance, the phone company to be liable for people planning crimes over the phone or engaging in phone scams, right? We don't want that because the phone company would immediately roll back its service from people it considered suspect or neighborhoods it considered risky. And for the sake of having a network that works well, we absolve those companies of responsibility. It's a long-standing principle. It's one that makes sense to just about everybody, except the Berlusconi government, apparently. He has been subject to a lot of ridicule, a lot of criticism in the big areas of emerging media that he does not control.
Is Google a particular target for regulators and legislators and politicians in Europe, more so than in the U.S.?
Yeah, it certainly is. The two biggest flashpoints in Europe right now are Google Street View and Google Book Search in places like Germany, in places like Switzerland and Greece. Google has faced tremendous backlash over Google Street View for, you know, deep historical reasons. Anyone who ever lived under the Stasi or the military junta in Greece is going to be concerned about any powerful party making an account of people's movements and presence. At the same time, Google Book Search, of course, directly confronts the pervasive awareness within Europe of the importance of cultural policy and the role of culture in national identity, in a sense of everyday quality of life, the sort of conversations that we tend not to have in the United States. Now, we've just found out this last week that Google's also under intense antitrust scrutiny for how it either offers or degrades access to competing search engines over there. Basically, European regulators are going to ask Google to peek under the hood.
They want to see the Google algorithm? You know, that's like the secret sauce. Right. That's merchandise 7X, the Coke formula. It's the nuclear secret.
That's going to be a major showdown within Europe. Google is overwhelmingly the dominant search engine in Western Europe. In places like the Netherlands, it's like 96% of the search market. It's much more powerful in Europe than it is even in the United States, where it's really only about 70%. And remember, here's the thing about the web. The web, we've decided long ago, shall be imperfectly regulated, if regulated at all. And we were going to be nervous about states or even the UN doing anything to touch how the web will develop. Well, Google stepped into the vacuum and has essentially become the soft power of the web, having a large say in what is important and what is true on the internet. And that's the sort of thing that makes people deeply nervous, to grant so much power to a fairly benign dictator, but a dictator nonetheless.
All right, Siva, thank you.
Anytime.
Siva Vaidyanathan is Associate Professor of Media Studies and Law at the University of Virginia.
On March 18th, in the Midtown Manhattan law offices of Windles, Marks, Lane, and Wittendorf, a public auction will be held. On the block, sex.com, one of the most coveted pieces of internet real estate ever. Expensive, too. Just to walk through the door, you'll need a bank-certified check for the amount of the opening bid, $1 million. But be warned, sex.com comes with a long and troubled past. It's all chronicled by Kieran McCarthy in Sex.com, One Domain, Two Men, 12 Years, and the Brutal Battle for the Jewel in the Internet's Crown. Kieran, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Good. So let's start at the beginning, 1994, when a guy named Gary Kremen registered the internet address sex.com. Who was this visionary?
He was a quintessential geek, the guy that starts up the tech company that doesn't have the best social skills but is incredibly bright. And he knew about domain names in 1994, which was a long time before most of the rest of us did. And so he registered Match.com, which is now a big dating site, and Autos.com and something else.com. He just registered a whole bunch of these domain names. And at the time, they were completely free.
So he grabbed the names. Did he do anything with them?
The irony is he didn't do anything with sex.com before it was stolen off him, because he was working hard on match.com. And he was always slightly embarrassed about sex.com. You know, lots of people hadn't registered sex.com because they thought, well, why would I want that?
So anyway, as you mentioned, he hadn't used sex.com before it got stolen out from under him by a con man named Stephen Cohen.
Well, Stephen Cohen is a remarkable character. He has very poor education, but he's incredibly intelligent. And every time he sees some new form of technology, he sees a way of using it to rip people off. What he actually did was he learned the systems by which you register domain names and changed the name of the registration from Gary Kremen's name to his name, but kept the address the same, and then applied again and said, oh, I've changed my address. And he produced this letter that claimed to have come from this company that Gary Kremer set up called Online Classifieds, saying Gary Kremer no longer works here, and so we have decided to hand over our rights to sex.com to this other person called Stephen Cohen because he has a pre-existing trademark in sex.com. This entire letter was a fabrication.
And so the other guy, Gary Kremen, sued, and it was a decade-long legal battle?
Yes, and it wasn't helped by the fact that Kremen's lawyers put in lots of different claims for relief. I think they put in something like 13 different claims. And that was 13 different ways in which Stephen Cohen could stall this. And that's what he did, because every time he delayed, he made more millions of dollars from sex.com.
I shudder to ask what kind of a site it was.
It was quite lazy, really. He just charged huge amounts of money for huge amounts of ads on this sex.com. So I think each ad, which he had dozens of, was something like $45,000 per month. And this was back in 2000.
Although Kremen eventually did win his case and made repeated efforts to recover some money from Cohen, he never got a dime, right?
Gary Kremen ultimately was awarded $65 million in compensation. And Stephen Cohen at this point shifted all of the money that was here in the U.S. to various offshore accounts, and he jumped across the border into Tijuana. Gary Kremen several times has offered to settle the whole thing for a small sum of money, but he will not do it because as long as he doesn't hand Gary Kremen any money, he feels that he still won.
And it turns out that Kremen didn't really want sex.com once he was back in possession of it.
He's not a porn baron, Gary Kremen. He doesn't like pornography particularly. And so when he won it, he made an announcement that he was going to make a clean version of sex.com. And this really annoyed a lot of people in the adult industry. So they pulled a lot of his advertising that was running on the site. So he suddenly found that the money that he was expecting to make plummeted. And I think when he was offered, you know, $14 million to sell it, he jumped at the chance.
And so what did that company do with it?
There were a company called Escom that was created in Delaware, and it's murky. I haven't been able to find out exactly who's behind it.
Somehow the words Delaware and murky always seem to come together.
They specifically set this up so people wouldn't know exactly who was behind it and what was going on exactly. And from what I understand, there was a lot of infighting. And for whatever reason, they've gone bankrupt, and their main asset is this domain name. And so that's what they're putting up for sale to pay off their creditors.
Kieran, you know the kind of store that's in a person's neighborhood and businesses keep changing, but no matter what goes into that particular spot, it always goes bankrupt in a few months?
I do. I know exactly what you mean. And sometimes they look really good.
What could look better than sex.com?
You're right. I remember talking to one of Gary Kremer's lawyers. And they told me that Gary, before he won it, would have this kind of crazy zeal in his eyes that this was the holy grail of the internet and that just by possessing it, you had some kind of totem-like power. It used to be like that. Before we had search engines, it was like that. But these days, it's not. These days, it's just a very, very good domain.
Kieran, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Kieran McCarthy is the author of Sex.com, One Domain, Two Men, 12 Years, and the Brutal Battle for the Jewel in the Internet's Crown.
There is an item up for auction on eBay. Well, how do I describe it? It's a black 8-inch cube made from acrylic. Inside there is a computer of sorts with an Ethernet cable emerging from a small hole on the back of the cube. Before bidding on this item, you have to agree to a series of terms. For example, if you win the bid, you must, when the item arrives at your home, hook it up to an internet connection, at which point the black box will put itself back up for auction. You've bought it, but it's not really yours, at least for long. On eBay, the object is titled A Tool to Deceive and Slaughter, and it's the brainchild of artist Caleb Larson, who joins me from Tulum, Mexico, where he lives. Caleb, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
First of all, I got to say, I'm not a huge conceptual art fan, but this piece is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen in any category of human endeavor ever. I simply love this artwork. Where did the idea come from?
The idea initially came from when I was working with a friend of mine who runs an online moped parts store. We started joking around about it would be much easier if there was a way to just simply make something that sold itself on eBay so we didn't have to go through all the hassle of finding products, listing them, and then doing this over and over again. A few months later, when I was back in graduate school in Rhode Island, the economic markets crashed everywhere. On the same weekend, Damien Hirst had his big auction at Sotheby's.
Damien Hirst, he of the shark suspended in formaldehyde, probably the most famous, certainly the best compensated contemporary artist.
The whole body of work sold for over $200 million. Prior to that, the highest auction record for one man was Pablo Picasso, and that was at $88 million. This all in the same weekend that Wall Street took its first big tumble. And the irony on that was not lost on me.
Or the potentiality, for that matter. This is one market that clearly had not crashed, eh?
Not yet. It came a little bit later. And so as an artist with a huge amount of debt, getting ready to finish graduate school, my mind started to turn, and my work as well, to finding ways of making money as an artist. And so this was sort of born from that.
And part of the deal is that if a subsequent auction raises the price of the work, you get a piece of that action, right?
Yeah, I get 15% of the appreciated value from the subsequent sales. So if it sold in one auction for $6,000 and then sold for $7,000 in another auction, I'm to receive 15% of that $1,000 increase.
Okay, so you originally put it up on eBay yourself. You were the beneficiary of the first auction price. What was that?
$6,500. Terrence Spies, the current collector who owns it, will be receiving it in the next week or so. When he does, he'll plug it into his Ethernet connection at his house, and it will go back up for sale again.
Let's just say this fella decides to flout the contract and not to plug it into the internet or even to the wall. Does he not still own your piece?
Well, according to the contract, no, because the way this whole thing was conceived is as both a physical object, the black box, as well as the potential for it to always be for sale, or the perpetual auction in this case. And so if one part of it doesn't exist, then the work as a whole doesn't exist. As part of the contract, it would sort of be disowned as a legitimate work of art, and its value would no longer be that of a work of art, but rather as just a collection of parts.
Now, I must ask you, and as a conceptual artist, you have to be willing to entertain this question. A work of art is not necessarily the property of its creator, nor is the meaning of the work of art necessarily determined solely by the creator. The viewer has a dog in this fight, too. And maybe this guy says, no, I'm just upping the ante on Caleb's concept. I say this is an even more interesting work of art because I have removed the perpetuity element of it. It may not be what he created, but it is what it now is. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that that is a valid and legitimate point, and perhaps that would be his artwork, but it would no longer be mine. In the same way that Rauschenberg went to Willem de Kooning, asked him for a drawing because he wanted to erase a William de Kooning drawing. And de Kooning thought this was a really fun idea, so he took a really, really heavily worked, really thickly drawn drawing and gave it to Robert Rauschenberg and said, here you go. And for weeks or months, Robert Rauschenberg sat there and erased the entire drawing and created a new work out of de Kooning's original work, which we've never seen. It was never documented. And he created the erased de Kooning. If a collector or another artist were to do that with my work, it would irritate me, but it would no longer be mine, and I would no longer have a part of it.
Assuming that eBay continues to exist, or some sort of online auction, and assuming the contract is never violated, you have created a perpetual motion machine. Far be it from me to try to get inside of your head, but it seems to me that at least one other point that this thing makes is to call attention to the question of whether anybody ever really owns a work of art.
That was one of the things that I was really enjoying while working on it, was that this was a work of art that maintained its own identity. A lot of artworks, certainly during the big boom within the last 10 years, were being bought on speculation, were being bought as investments. This work really kind of undermines its ability to be purchased as an investment or to be incorporated into a hedge fund or something like that. The work itself could be owned for as little as a week or as long as forever, but there's always the possibility that somebody could come and buy it from you. My hope is that one day it'll go into a museum collection, that a museum will be audacious enough to buy it, but then it could always leave the museum's collection at any point.
That would seem to be an issue. Caleb, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Caleb Larson is an artist. His work, A Tool to Deceive and Slaughter, is up for auction on eBay. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman. And it was edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Bill Bowen.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.